your problem with the bottom of the
chin. They see the door, they turn to the chain.
Okay, on the northbound access. It's right at the light.
Look, I think, Carl, what the hell did you do? I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on a donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, folks. This is your host with his good friend and partner, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
We're here tonight with my friend, retired FBI agent Bill Owsley, and we're going to talk about Nick Civella in Chicago and the Kansas City mob in Chicago, and we'll start back in the early years and bring it forward from that time when the two fledgling mafias were going on, the Black Hand days, and we're going to find out just how that connection first got started and where it is today. So, you know, why don't you say hello, Bill?
Bill, yes, that's me, and it's a pleasure to be here and do a podcast with you all.
All right, good. You know, Bill, talk a little bit about your books. You know, I went through and made notes for the show and brought myself up on some older history I don't know near as well as you do, and I have both your books, of course, so talk a little bit about them.
Well, the first book was called, or is called, Open City, which is the true story of the Kansas City crime family from 1900 to 1950. And just by a little background, reason it cuts off at 1950 is when I first started the project. I didn't realize the depth and scope of the history of this family and city. And it took me 300 and some pages just to cover 1950. So it is the developmental years of the Kansas City crime family. The second book I wrote was Mobsters in Our Midst. It took up the story and generally followed the career or the reign, the longest reign of a mob boss, that of Nick Civella. And took it through his years through a domineering case that sort of brought the mob down.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Now, where can you get those? Amazon, I suppose, Amazon.com?
Amazon.com has it, yes, and both books.
Okay, good. Are they in Kindle also? Both of them in Kindle? I can't remember.
Yeah, Open City is in Kindle, and the other one is an ebook on another format called The Pronoun, which was done by the prior publisher. I don't know much about it, but how you get it through them, I'm not sure.
All right. Well, let's take a look at Amazon.com. And if you have any questions about that, you just go to my website and send me a message through the website, and I'll get back with you and tell you how you can get a copy of that book. You know, we're going to talk about this. And Bill and I were talking just before we got started tonight, and some things I didn't really realize is how far back and how this connection with Chicago started. It goes all the way back to when horse racing was big, right, Bill?
Yeah, it that had a lot to do with it, because one of the main players in the family here was a fellow called Tony Gizzo. And Gizzo was a owner of horses, also was the mob's liaison man and traveled extensively, making contacts around the country. Through those contacts and the horse racing, which was a reason for his travel, maybe to shadow his real reasons to meet these people. But he became very close with the Chicago crime family.
What was it? You know, a lot of people out there are real mob fans, and they'll know about the Kefauver Commission, the Kefauver Committee, which was formed in 1950 to interview mobsters all around the United States to find out to expose, you know, the extent of mafia infiltration into local politics and to labor unions and expose some of their criminal endeavors. And what was it that Mr. Kefauver said to Gizzo about, was he was a well-traveled fellow or something like that?
The Kefauver Committee went around the country, and of course, their inquiries into the various cities and their organized crime factions. And at the end, he said Gizzo was one of the most well-traveled, well-connected mobsters that he had come across in his inquiries.
Interesting, right here in the heart of the country. You know, another thing, prohibition. Of course, we all know that the modern mafia or La Cosa Nostra outfit in Chicago, you know, that's what we ought to go ahead and make sure you guys know that Chicago, I believe, is the only one other than Kansas City that calls themselves the outfit. Is that not correct?
I think that's right.
And in Kansas City, you know, I interviewed a guy one time named Scudero. Was it Scoots? Mm. He called it the Click.
Yeah.
Have you heard that, the Click?
Yeah. In fact, when I first came here and started working the program for the local FBI office, that was the principal name people used was the Click.
Al Capone, everybody knows Al Capone, one of probably the most well-known gangsters in the United States in history, and you know that they formed the kind of modern permutation of the crime syndicate, which went outside of Italians a little bit, outside of Sicilians, and brought in Jewish gangsters and some other ethnic backgrounds to form this criminal syndicate and built around bootlegging during Prohibition, because there was so much money to be made, just huge amount of money. And Chicago and Kansas City also started doing business with each other with alcohol. For example, what's a good example of that, Bill?
Well, first of all, Prohibition graduated from local making of illicit beer and spirits in bathtubs and in local places, and then it graduated to bringing in the good stuff from Canada and from abroad, and so you had avenues opened up. So there were connections with Chicago during Prohibition because the proximity and what have you. So there were ties then, and then there were ties after the repeal when liquor became legitimate again. Well, these, who knew liquor better than these mobsters? And they became distributors and got some of the main distributorships like Schlitz and Schenley and all of that, besides making their own beer. And one interesting part of that history was Johnny Torrio, who was Capone's mentor, got a hold of a brewery. It had a variation of names over the years, but it became known as Capone Beer. And of course, they came to Kansas City, got a hold of their local people like Gizzo, who they knew, and introduced Canadian Ace Beer, which most people said was awful beer, but you distributed it in Kansas City or else.
You know, another story, you mentioned something about Johnny Lazia, who was the mob boss in the 30s, and a story about him wanting to buy a Schlitz beer distributorship.
Yeah, there was a local family here who were very legitimate people, and they had a brewery before Prohibition. Being law-abiding, they closed down, went to making soda and what have you during Prohibition. And then with repeal, they were able to renegotiate their Schlitz beer distributorship, which was a very lucrative distributorship to have. Well, they were visited one day by John Lazia, the local boss, and he made him an offer to buy out their place, and he wanted the Schlitz distributorship. As I say, the mob wanted back into this business now that it was legitimate. Well, this family of law-abiding citizens said to John Lazia, thank you, but no thank you. And Lazia, gentlemanly-like, said thank you very much for your time and left. And the next thing we know is Lazio turns to his Chicago affiliates, the family has found their distributorship rescinded, and John Lazio now is the Schlitz distributor.
Once again, this early, early connection with Chicago and working closely with the Chicago mob. So, you know, during Prohibition, and this all starts, it probably started a little bit before that, but we're first seeing the evidence of it, I think, because they have to work together to facilitate this bringing alcohol in, particularly from Canada, because the good stuff came in Canada, so mm-hmm. it had to come down through Chicago and mm-hmm. Milwaukee and the northern borders. You know, Nick Savella's a young guy during this time. And Nick Savella, I read up a little bit about him, and I understand his father was maybe victimized by the Black Hand. They extorted money from him when he was a kid. He was arrested at age 10 as an incorrigible. I'm not sure what that means, but especially at age 10, but he was an incorrigible. Probably wouldn't go to school, more than likely. He was arrested for bootlegging. Probably everybody who wanted to be a mobster was arrested for bootlegging during Prohibition and did 3 months in a Jackson County jail. But Nick Savella, talk a little bit about his early days with this ruling heads of the mob in Kansas City. It seemed like he was a little bit like the Vito Corleone character in The Godfather. He didn't really fit in with the ruling fathers of the mob back then, did he?
Well, yeah, no, he didn't. Nick was, as you say, arrested at 10 as an incorrigible and graduated there to petty street crimes, mainly. Had a long arrest record, many investigation arrests, which were common in that day. He was raised, of course, in the North End, the Italian North End, and was certainly aware of the criminal element at that time, which the Italian budding family, the Black Hand era, was in force, and he didn't particularly cotton to these people. As you say, his father was abused in his eyes. That's the story anyway. He didn't believe in these extortionate tactics of his own people. So he did not seek their approval. He did not seek to be recruited by them. As he got older, he was another of the street people that they did try to recruit as the family grew. But he resisted and, in fact, went against the mob, forming a small street gang of his own and opting to rob their own gambling games.
Interesting. You know, and he probably was relatively uneducated. Hardly anybody went to school past the eighth grade back then anyhow, and especially out in the country. Unless you had money, I know my mom talks about, unless you had money, you did not go to high school. And she was born in 1915, about the same era as Nick Savella, really. And so he really was uneducated, but he was very cunning, had a lot of native intelligence, I understand. And let's listen to a tape from a guy. It's kind of a different view of Nick Savella. This is a man named Phil Cardarello, who's in my movie Gangland Wire. And an interesting thing about Phil is he worked for the law firm that represented Nick Savella. And so he knew him on a professional basis, but he also knew him on a more personal basis. So listen to this tape and what Mr. Cardarello has to say about Nick Savella.
Nick Savella was one of the brightest guys you'd ever want to meet. Not in terms of having gone a long way through school, but, and I guess the comparison in some ways is apt, like Harry Truman, he learned a lot because he read a lot.
So very interesting that he says he was much like Harry Truman. He was smart because he read a lot. Was he that smart? Was he a pretty bright guy, Bill? You knew him personally, more professionally, but more on a personal level than I ever did.
Well, Nick did have, I'd have to give him that. He had an intellect. He had an ability to, there's a difference between reading and comprehending and grasping concepts and ideas and even legal theories. He became very legally astute because we had him in court so much. And he was able to grasp grasp things. So I would say he was an intelligent individual. Yes, a native intelligence. It wasn't your school learned intelligence.
Well, you would think that it would take a little bit more than street smarts to rise to the level that he did.
Yeah, but there have been some bosses around the country that, for example, John Gotti, who couldn't in intellect touch Nick Civella. He was just a thug. So not all of them had Nick's character traits. I think Nick stood above many mob bosses that I've been familiar with.
Like his ability to kind of see through things, to navigate on behalf of the best interest of their organization.
Absolutely, you got it right, because he was a reasonable person. He was, for example, I'll give you a very quick story. Some mobsters from California and I think Colorado, but anyway, they came to see Nick because they wanted to extort some people in Las Vegas. And Nick laughed at him and he said, "This is the 1970s. He says, "What you're talking about went out with high button shoes." So a guy from Chicago might have said, "Yeah, let's go get him and beat the hell out of him or extort him." But Nick could see the changing times. Mm-hmm. He understood trends and what was doable and what wasn't, and what was good for the family and good for him. He kept the family small and controllable. He didn't have big pretensions because he knew that's bigger problems, more people you had to take care of.
He also understood the value of bad publicity, just like we were talking before. Is what was your quote, that if publicity is bad for them and good for the government
and good for us, right?
He understood that, and you know, extorting people is if it falls down on you, is bad publicity. But if you can make a loan to a guy and buy a casino and then have him siphon money out to you, and it's a big, huge amount of steady flow of money, and even if it falls down, it's not bad publicity, you know. But extorting money is directly like that, bad publicity. Killing people is bad publicity. Right. He was not big on killing people unless it was absolutely necessary.
Yeah, and he also understood that by that time, federal government, the local entities were all on top of organized crime. You weren't going to get away with some of that hardcore stuff anymore.
Right, and they'd loosen up the tax dollars when it started hitting the papers, murders.
Yeah,
they start loosening up the tax dollars and say, let's add some more agents, let's add more policemen into investigating this stuff. This is real. But, you know, kind of back to the connection to Chicago, we kind of diverted a little bit there. From reading your book, and I knew this from talking to you before, that about 1940, he went to Chicago twice to hide out because he was in trouble with the mob for the reasons that you just said, that he was not kowtowing to what the mob guys wanted. He had this gang, and they were robbing protected gang games. And in December 2nd, 1940, in your book, it says that one of his gang members, a guy named James Maroon, was a victim of a mob hit. And shortly thereafter, he left for Chicago. And what's interesting, this is the early December, and by Christmas in 1940 in Chicago, Nick is arrested for the robbery of a dance hall up there. And a Chicago policeman had ordered him to halt, and when he failed to stop, the cop shot him. And I guess he didn't kill him, obviously, he went on and went to trial, and he had a pretty good defense. I'll have to admit, this is a good defense, unless there's some other smoking gun, that he was merely innocent party leaving the dance hall, got caught in a crossfire, and he ended up being found not guilty by a Chicago judge. Then he came back to Kansas City after that. Is that that's correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did.
A mob guy doesn't go to another city and start doing crimes without somebody in the other city's mob knowing that they're there and that they're doing them, wouldn't you say?
Well, except for the fact that at that time, Nick was really not connected because he was in Chicago hiding from a murder contract issued by Big Jim Ballesteri for having defied the mob. You know, it's one thing to resist recruitment. It's another thing to defy them openly.
Right.
That is not forgiven. And so that gang was all marked for murder. Nick escaped because some of his early associates, street thugs and guys who graduated to the mob and accept recruitment, still had a loyalty to Nick, a friendship, a bond. They, without them, he would have been dead, but they warned him several times of Ballesteri's attempts.
Oh, that's how he happened to leave that first time.
Right. So after Maroon was shot.
Interesting.
After Maroon was shot, he said, well, you know, they're really serious, and I don't know how long I can make it right now. I'm going to have to let things cool. And he went to Chicago and pulled that job. And I think probably mainly because he needed the money. And but fortunately was able to get some assistance from the Chicago mob. How he did that, we're not sure. It could have been a word from a friendly person here. But then he came back.
Is it possible that he committed, that wasn't maybe the only crime he committed when he was there?
But we don't really know.
Don't really know.
Yeah, he could have. That's the one he got caught with.
Yeah.
So, he may have been
actively committing crimes
in order to survive. Because he wasn't going to get the support right away of the Chicago mob because he's a guy hiding.
And you would think they would know that, wouldn't they?
Well, you know, they would have an obligation if Kansas City told the Chicago people, you know, this guy, we need him dead. They couldn't ignore him if they knew exactly where he was. Now, some chemistry happened in there we don't know. That he did get assistance, and he got assistance in that court case too. That's some of the history that's lost to the ages.
So, you know, he comes back. This is during the war, and I guess I have a quick. This is an aside. Do you know what did Nick Civella do? What did the mob do during the war? And the war changed everything. And I don't really read much about it.
Many of them went and served. You know, many of them did. How Nick escaped it, probably he would have been unacceptable because of his criminal record and all. But as for the mob, it was a heyday because of they were able to black market all of the products that we were not allowed to have.
Oh.
You know, sugar and bacon and fat and all these different things that were, they had ration stamps.
It was probably active market in ration stamps.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it was a boon time for organized crime because they had a way of finding all and getting all these things and putting them out on the black market.
You know, I talked to this guy again, Scudero, and he told me a story that he was in the service during the war, and on his way back on the troop ship, these huge, you know, several thousand troops on a troop ship coming home from Europe, and he and a lieutenant, I believe, formed a little co-op, and they ran a store where they bought stuff and then sold it to these service guys, and they made so much money that he stayed in and made a couple of more trips to continue to make money on selling this stuff that it was kind of like off the books, off the records. They weren't really weren't sanctioned by the military to do it, but they had this little operation going. So they're always looking for an angle, aren't they?
Yep.
And that was an angle that he found.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's one of the hallmarks of Cosa Nostra is to take advantage of all cultural changes, societal changes, political changes, the ups and downs of our daily life create new opportunities all the time.
Interesting. Well, let's go to right after the war. And once again, Nick Savelle again appears to be in trouble. In 1946, one of his associates, a guy named or called, his first name was Joseph Buggy Anch. Is it Anch?
Anch.
Anch. Buggy Anch. And he's found dead. And he had been beat up and shot in a kind of a brutal manner. Probably that means they needed to talk to him a little bit or needed to set an example of some kind. Mm-hmm. So, and he was one of Nick's criminal associates that probably been robbing these protected games. Is that?
He was one of the crew.
Yeah.
Well, so, when he was one of the crew, Nick leaves. I mean, this is after the war, but Nick goes off to Chicago. The contract on his life didn't come up just because he was gone a while.
No.
And then obviously these other guys who were part of the same gang that's decided for whatever reason to stay in Kansas City still were marked men.
Yeah, and I guess they either were successful in evading, knowing that you have a contract is one thing, obviously I think they were just successful in evading
being killed.
The killers. And whereas Nick decided that he would flee to make sure, but the contract as far they're being marked for murder, I don't think changed.
No, it obviously wasn't off on Nick because shortly after Buggy Anch is killed, Nick's sitting in a car with a Jackson County deputy sheriff named Louis Cuccia. And it's at the Trucker's Liquor Store at 1901 East 15th Street. It's in my app if you want to go visit that.
It's still there?
It's still – no, well, actually, it's I think it's a parts store now. Mm. Mainly it's a lot there. And it was called the Trucker's Liquor Store, and he had slid over so the deputy could sit in the driver's seat. So they're sitting there talking late at night, and two men pull into the lot, exit the car, and I think with a shotgun and a machine gun, because there's a picture in Bill's book, there's a picture of that car he was riding in, and it is just filled with bullet holes on one side. And they shoot at the driver's side and kill the deputy sheriff. And Nick, of course, I'm sure I could just see Nick, can't you, Bill, ducking and rolling out of that passenger's door and heading out into the neighborhoods out away from that liquor store. So it was a really strong, hard run at Nick to claim. And so obviously that contract from the 40s, 1940 was still on, 1946, and they're still trying to get him. So what happens to Nick after that? He goes back to Chicago again. Now, this is where it gets interesting, I think. Don't you, Bill? The Gizzo Cherry Nose Gioi. Would that be how you pronounce that, Gioi?
Yeah,
story?
Something like that.
You know, we're about 30 minutes, I think.
Just a little over 30 minutes.
Pretty close. Why don't we wind this down and we will...
Actually, got like a minute 20.
Okay, let's
finish. So maybe we should quickly mention...
Finish this one off. Go ahead, Aaron.
That if you enjoy the podcast, make sure you get one of the Gangland Wire t-shirts.
Oh, yeah. You can buy a t-shirt on my website.
That's right. Or you could make a donation and we'll give you...
I'll give you a t-shirt.
Or a DVD copy.
Correct.
Of your documentary, Gangland Wire.
And go to... subscribe to it on iTunes or in the Google Play Store. Well, I guess you only do it in your podcast app. Simply, I'm on Stitcher and Podcaster and iTunes. But in iTunes, you can give me a review. And give me a review. If you give me a review, of course, it probably ought to be a good review, but give me a review and let me know and show me that review. Email me and you can contact through the website, and I will send you one of those t-shirts or a DVD. So anyhow, it helps us. It helps us go up in the ratings and helps more people find the show. I'm focusing on Chicago right now. I'm going to try to get some listeners out of Chicago. We've got them all over the world.
Yeah, you just posted something up like a Google map of known locations.
Yeah.
That's Chicago.
Yeah.
That was somebody else's. But
that's somebody. Well, I'm doing that for Kansas City, too. That's next.
But you should also, if you're enjoying the podcast, check out our guest, Bill Owsley's book, Mobsters in Our Midst.
And Open City. Get those on Amazon. So, Aaron, do my little public service announcement. Can you remember that?
I have to remember.
Let's get out of here and we'll
I'm trying to remember. I have to do it right off the cuff.
This is my favorite. You're the radio guy, man. This is my favorite nonprofit. It's called First Call. And First Call, if you have a problem or you have an employee or a relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol or any other kind of addictive behavior, addictive substances, make First Call your first call. It's 816-361-5900 or go to www.firstcallkc.com and ask their help. They'll be a big help to you.
All right.
Good night, Aaron.
Good night.
Night, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
Good night. Thank you for having me.